This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We've just learned that Edward Bunker, a crime novelist and actor who learned his writing craft in prison, died earlier this month in California from complications following surgery on his legs. He was 71. Bunker grew up in Southern California foster homes, and at age 17 became the youngest inmate in San Quentin after he'd stabbed a guard at a youth detention facility. He spent 18 years in some of the nation's toughest prisons for robbery, forgery, and selling drugs. But he studied writing and published his first novel, No Beast So Fierce, while he was still at San Quentin. The novel, about an ex-con who can't get legit work and returns to crime, was made into the film Straight Time, starring Dustin Hoffman. Bunker wrote three other novels about crime and prison life, and in 2000 published a memoir called Education of a Felon. Bunker co-authored the movie script of Straight Time and wrote the screenplay for the action film Runaway Train. Bunker also had 22 acting roles, including Mr. Blue in Quentin Tarantino's 1992 film Reservoir Dogs. Terry Gross spoke to Edward Bunker in 1993. He began with a reading from the opening of his first novel, No Beast So Fierce.
I sat on the littlest toilet at the rear of the cell, shining the hideous bulb-toe shoes that were issued to those being released. Through my mind ran an exultant chant, "I'll be a free man in the morning." But for all the exultation, the joy of leaving after 8 calendars in prison was not unalloyed. My goal in buffing the ugly shoes was not so much to improve their appearance as to relieve tension. I was more nervous in facing release on parole than I had been on entering so long ago. It helped slightly to know that such apprehensiveness was common, though often denied, by men to whom the world outside was increasingly vague as the years passed away. Enough years in prison and a man would be as ill-equipped to handle the demands of freedom as a Trappist monk thrown into the maelstrom of New York City. At least the monk would have his faith to sustain him, while a former prisoner would possess memory of previous failure, of prison, and the incandescent awareness of being an ex-convict, a social outcast.
Thank you for reading that. Edward Bunker, do you know that on the author bio, on the press release that accompanies the republication of No Beast So Fierce, it says, Edward Bunker has not been arrested in over 20 years. It's an unusual thing to find on an author bio. Did you want that mentioned on there?
Yeah, sure I want that mentioned. Yeah, because, people have the image of the convict writer Jack Abbott kind of ruined things, and Smith and other people who, have written and have, people, Buckley went to bat for Smith and Mailer for Abbott, and they got in trouble quick, committed rapes, murders, robberies. I'm somebody that's really been rehabilitated. So, I like the idea that I haven't been arrested for 20 years. That's kind of changes things, I mean, don't you think it's salient?
Absolutely. How many times did you get out of prison and end up going back in?
Three times. I was a three-time, three times. I was a three-time loser.
Why is it so hard to live a straight life after prison?
The term habitual criminal is really an appropriate term. But there's a whole lot of things. One's life, you're locked. When you're in prison, your dreams have no limit. You can dream about anything, and the reality of the world is that when you get out, you're locked out of society. I mean, there's really, the idea of the prodigal is really not accepted too much in Puritan America. I mean, I've had people tell me that they shouldn't allow me to write, and, just, you're locked out of society. That's essential fact once you've been in. And you're accepted, and you have a group that you're accepted by.
In prison?
In prison, amongst thieves and criminals. And
how did you get an agent when you were in prison?
I wrote this agent and told him that I was here in prison and I aspired to write, and they had done an issue in Esquire magazine about writer, the New York literary world, and they had a chart of how they do in magazines and these agents and that agent, and this was Ayn Rand's agent, originally had been Ayn Rand's agent and was the real old agency in New York, one of the first ones. So I wrote them and explained my situation and if they'd be interested in reading my stuff. And so I sent it to them, and they said, we can't sell this. We do anything else, send it to us. So every time I'd write one of those novels, every 2 or 3 years, I'd send them when they'd say no. And finally, on the sixth one, he said, I think I can sell this.
You wrote 6 novels before the one was published.
Right. I wrote for 17 years before I got published.
Did you show it to any of your fellow prisoners?
Oh, yeah. I used to write dirty stories that I'd rent for cigarettes on the joint, too, you know. That's why I made my cigarettes, you know, and coffee. And I'd write reports. After a couple of years, I had very, you know, powerful clerical positions in the state prison. I was associate warden's clerk, and because I could write so well. And, you know, those reports that go to Sacramento and the district attorney's office and things like that, so I did a lot of that writing, you know, report writing and stuff. And I would write letters for guys, and I got into law. I studied law. I worked as a law librarian for 3 or 4 years.
Well, your novel is about an unrepentant criminal. I imagine that didn't really help your reputation among prison authorities.
No. In fact, I once wrote an essay on how to commit an armed robbery, a primer on planning and commission of successful armed robberies. They found it in my cell. They really didn't like that. But I don't think they paid any attention to this book. I don't think they read very much, the prison authorities. And I wanted to write about an unrepentant criminal because there's a question always between how much is choice and how much is determined by life. I mean, I think my observation in life is that people who succeed always attribute their success to their own virtues, and people that fail always blame their failure on bad luck. And I don't know which is luck and which is virtue. And I wanted to be somebody that chose to be a criminal. I mean, I made my, whatever his predisposition by circumstances, I believe in free choice. He chose to be a criminal. I chose to be a criminal, you know, because I wouldn't be what society would let me be.
Now, the novel No Beast So Fierce was first published in 1973. I believe you were paroled that year also?
Yeah.
Was that before or after the publication?
I was in when it was published.
And when were you paroled?
I was paroled later on, about a year and a half later.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you that time when you got out of prison? You know, you had a novel. You could have gotten to a bookstore and bought looked at your book there.
Well, it was very different. I left in a limousine. They sent a limousine for me. We were going to make a movie. I was in pre-production of making Straight Time. And so they sent a limousine for me. That was a far different situation. Of course, they could have taken me around the block and dumped me out. I didn't care after they got away, you know. But my relationship with the world changed.
Was that the last time you were in prison?
Yep. And last time I was arrested.
In the introduction to your book, you thank Dustin Hoffman for carrying you for 6 months. You're referring to the time you worked with
another
him.
Another book. That's in, you mean in the...
That's in your other book.
The dedication of
that's
Little
right.
Boy Blue. Yeah, he did. I mean, they hired me when I got out. They hired me as a technical consultant and paid me all the way through pre-production and production. Gave me I did an acting job. I played a role in the movie. Got a SAG card. And so it changed my life. I mean, it didn't change me, but it changed my relationship with the world. I think I've changed. I've changed kind of over time. So I changed slowly. But when I got out, I didn't have any different attitude than I'd always had. But my relationship with society changed. I'd been on the cover of Harper's Magazine. I had a book published. I had another one in production. I had a movie being made. That's a whole lot of different situation than getting out, you know, with $40 in your pocket.
Tell me about one of the days when you got out with $40 in your pocket.
Oh, well, I got out one time with $40. And they'd given me the dress-out shoes. I was trying to get a job, and I remember this very clearly in Los Angeles. It was one of those hot L.A. days, you know, that really gets smoking 100 degrees. And I was walking around, and I had blisters from these shoes, these new cheap shoes that they'd given me, these dress-out shoes. And I'm walking from job application, trying to get a job. And it was so bad that I had blisters on my blisters. And no money, you know, in a little furnished room, and the rent's running out, and the parole officer's on my case. And, yeah, it was,
How long were you out?
That time?
Mm-hmm.
About 7 months, 8 months.
What landed you back in?
That time, I think I got caught with a safe in my car, a small safe. in the back of my car after a long chase and some checks from another safe burglary.
You pulled a bank heist once, right?
Yeah, I pulled several. But the one that's really funny is the one I got. I had in 72. I had been busted over the drugs, and I got out on bail, and they were following me, expecting me to pick up another load of drugs, and I was going to rob a bank in Beverly Hills and go to flee to Mexico. And I didn't know it, and they had a beeper on my car, a helicopter, and 5 carloads of narcs, and they followed me to a bank right on Wilshire Boulevard, right in the middle of Beverly Hills. And as I was robbing the bank, I looked up through the window, and there was some guy had his both hands, and he was pressed up to the glass looking in the bank from the street. And I recognized his face. I didn't know his name, but I recognized his face, and I knew it was a cop. So I ran out the other door, and the chase was on, you know, and I wondered why I couldn't get away. But, you know, the beeper and the helicopter. And they caught me over by Farmer's Market. And that was the worst. I thought I was going to get 20 years, 30 years. I thought it was all over. I was a two-time loser with a, you know, ex-convict with a bank. That's as hot as it can get, you know. And while I was in the jail, they accepted my novel. And after over a few months, then people came to my assistant. I had a lot of letters, and I tried to kill myself that night. That's the bleakest point of my life. Yeah, because I thought it was all over. I tried to hang myself, and I used a piece of pajama top, and it broke. I went out. I went unconscious, you know, and I was hanging, and it broke. When I woke up, I was on the floor.
What were your first thoughts when you woke up?
I don't remember, you know, but, you know, I was dizzy, I guess, you know. Well, that didn't work.
Were you changed afterwards? Did you know?
No, was that a great metamorphosis that happened?
Yeah,
all of us?
No, I don't think, luck, huh?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that change happens like that.
Yeah.
I don't believe in flashes of, like lightning.
So you came to
although you were still really depressed. Huh?
You came to and you were still really depressed.
I was still really depressed, but things, you know, the world started slowly changing because I had accomplished something. Although I do know other people who have had, that kind of lightning. I had a guy I know that was doing time in California, and they took him to Nevada. When he finished his sentence, he had charges pending in Nevada, and he was facing a lot of time. And he said, he made one of those prayers, one of those deals with God, if I could get out of this, and I don't. It was an old crime, like he'd already served a sentence in California, and they were taking him there. Anyway, they dismissed the charges the next week, and he changed. He became a Christian minister, and he runs a home for abused children, and, you know, and that was kind of like lightning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one I know of.
Do you ever go back to prison to teach now?
Yeah, I went to Terminal Island a few times. Used to have a writing class in there. And I help people as much as I can help them. Guys write me, and I read their stuff, you know.
What's it like for you now when you go in? You know, when you go into teach or whatever.
Well, it's all right. I mean, I'm a legend in my own time, you know. Or as some guy said, I'm a legend in my own slime, you know.
Crime novelist and actor Edward Bunker speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. He died earlier this month. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with crime novelist Edward Bunker. He died earlier this month. Bunker spent 18 years in some of the nation's toughest prisons, and he published his first novel while he was still at San Quentin.
You stabbed a guard at a prison once.
Yeah, when I was 15 years old.
Was that during a prison riot?
No, it was I had escaped from the hole, and I was going to stab an informer, a stool pigeon, and they cornered me and threw tear gas, and I jumped out a window, and one of them tackled me from behind, and when I went down, I stabbed him. Not bad, but, you know.
How were you punished for that?
Well, I was, they took me out and put me in the L.A. County Jail on what they call high power, which was all the cases facing death penalties and things. I was there for a while, and I got, the judge gave me probation, and then because I was so young, I was only 15, turned 16, there was no place to send me. I'd already been through all the juvenile joints, so he gave me a county jail sentence, and I got out, and I went back in, And then I escaped from the jail, and finally they sent me to San Quentin. So I wound up doing about 6 years on the charge. That was the charge that I went to prison for.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel anything for the guard that you stabbed?
No. I mean, like remorse or bad for him. I didn't hurt him very bad. He wasn't hurt very bad. I mean, I was hurt a lot worse than he was, believe me.
When you were young, did crime give you an identity, a sense of yourself?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I was always adventurous, and I didn't want to go along with the program. I mean, I was a chronic runaway, and one thing leads to another. You get, you know, most, they start young. My parents were divorced when I was 4, and they put me in foster homes, and I was a chronic runaway. Well, you run away, and you steal a bicycle to get away. And you're hungry, and you break into a little market, you know, and steal stuff, and one thing progresses to another, and they catch you and you go to juvenile hall, and some guy teaches you how to hotwire a car, and it's a value. You develop a whole ethical and a value system, an underworld antisocial value system. And it's accepted by the peer group, by those around you, and it becomes yours. You know, that's how anybody does. They accept the value system that they're taught. Everybody is what they're taught.
You were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for a while?
Once upon a time, yeah.
What got you on there?
It was really some forgeries and suspicion of something that I wasn't guilty of, but it was really, I was wanted for forgeries. Those were was the charge.
Were you proud in a way? Did you feel like you'd made it to the top?
Well, it's kind of a, I wouldn't say proud, but it scared me, I know that, but... because it puts a lot more heat on you. They used to only put you on the 10 most wanted when they knew they were going to arrest you the next day.
To look impressive?
To look impressive, that's true, you know. And it kept me from going to Cuba. I was in Florida at the time in Miami, and it was when Castro was still in the mountains of in Cuba, and I thought I was going to go down there and join him.
To be a revolutionary?
Yeah. You know, essentially, I wanted to get away from here.
Did anybody recognize you from your 10 most wanted FBI photo that appeared in post offices when you were on the most wanted list?
No, but I was afraid that they would.
Uh-huh.
That's what made me hesitant to try, and I didn't know it. And I was in Florida, I was in Miami, and I went into a post office and I saw my picture there. It scared me to death, and that's really the reason I didn't go. You know.
Did you run out of the post office?
No, I didn't quite, but I left quickly. You know what I mean? I don't think I quite ran, but I got out of there. You know.
Was it a good photo?
No, it was a bad photo. But still, who knows, you know? Be surprised how many people, you know, recognize you.
Right. So it's been 20 years since you were in prison. What have you been doing for the past 20 years? How have you earned a living? What's your day-to-day life like?
I live the life of a writer. I work as a writer. I do all right. My books do fairly well. I get some movie writing work, rewriting work. I get a little acting work here and there. I live a very kind of very quiet life. It's pretty good. I have a great life, actually. I sleep. I get up. I go to eat breakfast. I clean the house. Do all the housework, and I write. I write 7 days a week, and I have good friends. I have a good wife.
Do you find yourself being shocked now at the kinds of crimes that are committed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's the gratuitous violence, the premium on violence. And I'm really one of these people. I believe that you take role models and Cagney and Bogart and those guys back then, well, they'd kill a dirty rat. But now Al Pacino just cuts loose with a machine gun and kills everybody. And I believe that life imitates art. I believe that the level of violence in the arts and movies and television really affects the society. I believe it has and I am shocked by the degree of gratuitous violence that's, you know, people don't, I mean, I just wanted to steal money, love. You know, I didn't want to hurt nobody. You know, I may hurt somebody if I had to, but now they want to rob you and they want to hurt you too. And that's a whole lot of difference, you know.
Do you think that although you don't commit crimes anymore, you'll be writing about them for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah, because that's what I know about, you know. I write about other things, too. I got a dog story, too, and I'm trying to hustle, you know. But essentially, I write about criminal. That's what, you know, Dostoevsky wrote. I mean, you know, after he went to prison for 7 years, that's what he wrote about. You know. That's what they tell you, you know, rule number one of creative writing, write about what you know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, dear.
Crime novelist and actor Edward Bunker speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. He died earlier this month at the age of 71.